Life Show. I'm Robin Daly, your host for the show and chairman of the UK registered charity Yes to Life, that for 12 years has been helping people with cancer to access the many benefits of integrative medicine. My guest today is a man who's been campaigning on behalf of men with prostate cancer since his own diagnosis and successful treatment, which placed a heavy reliance on lifestyle medicine. Peter Starr is a filmmaker who has, amongst many other things, put together a documentary in which he has collected together expertise from around the world in support of his mission. I'm talking to him over Skype at his home in California. Hi Peter, great to be able to talk to you today. Thanks a lot for coming on the Yes to Life show.
Robert, it's my pleasure. It's good to be heard in England again. As you know, I'm an ex-Brit, expat living in Los Angeles, a Coventry kid by birth. And so it's always nice to be heard in England from time to time, but thank you.
Great. So you've got a film out currently that's provocatively called Surviving Prostate Cancer Without Surgery, Drugs or Radiation. Many people, not least of all the vast majority of oncologists, of course, would probably think that anyone making a film under that banner was barking mad, to use a traditional English phrase. So what gives you the confidence to make a film with a title like this?
Well, in 2004, which is now 13 years ago, I was diagnosed with prostate cancer. And quite honestly, the attitude of the urologist that diagnosed me was such that I was just freaked out about what he said and how he said it. And I've used the phrase often enough that he had the bedside manner of a Neanderthal. And that's what prompted me to start doing my own research. And I determined then that this, what he wanted to do to me, was not the way I wanted to go. And I backed up with my thoughts and my intuition with actual scientific facts and started researching natural healing for cancer generally and prostate cancer in particular. And it took me a while, to be quite honest, to do the research before I even started making the film. And it was about 4 years before I really had the confidence that I knew what I was talking about to actually go out and start making a film. So all in all, I started the film probably in about 2009, finished it in 2012, went around the world, literally to 8 countries on 3 continents, interviewing some of the best doctors that I could find. And I've learned more since then from other doctors, but this was the state of the art in my knowledge at the time. And it's proven to be of great help to a lot of people, a lot of men that have watched it and said, you know, you really helped us a lot. You gave us a different perspective on their particular disease. And it was on television in the USA over the last year or so on what we call our PBS system, which is loosely equivalent to your BBC over there.
Mm-hmm. So can you tell us a little bit about your own experience then? So first of all, were you in the US or the UK when you got this diagnosis?
I was in the U.S. I've lived here for 30 years, and my background is that I've been working in the motion picture business on both sides of the camera, actually, as an actor and a stunt performer on one end, and as a documentary filmmaker for the last 30-some-odd years. Mm. And when I got diagnosed, it was right here in Los Angeles, and I got diagnosed in an interesting way because my PSA was only 1.2, which most people would never get to. Nobody would suspect cancer at that point. No. But my doctor did a DRE and felt what he felt was a nodule. And
for
so
our
I
listeners,
to go see the urologist.
For our listeners, we'd like to explain what a DRE is.
Well, a DRE is where the doctor puts on a rubber glove and some Vaseline or other lubricant, puts his finger into the rectum and actually feels the prostate through the rectum wall. Mm. And he feels it to see whether it's soft enough to be natural or whether it's hard enough to be what a lot of prostates are as we get older. Or he feels it for nodules that are protruding from the outside of the prostate, which is what he found with me. And that feeling, without any further ado, said, I want you to go to see the urologist. And so that's what I did.
Okay.
And the urologist did a DRE and concurred with the general practitioner that we ought to do a biopsy. And at that point, I have to tell you, I was totally ignorant of so many things, and probably like so many other men that never even think into the medical terms, I had no idea what a biopsy was. I'd heard the term, but I had no idea what it was, particularly with regards to the prostate. So I had no input into this. We should do a biopsy, or we are going to do a biopsy, which were his exact phrases. And I love the way he used we, looking back on that.
Right.
But they did a biopsy, and they found cancer. And it was they determined it was a Gleason 7, a 3 plus 4. And with that diagnosis, he immediately says, we're going to take that out. We need to remove that prostate immediately.
Hmm. Do you want to just fill in a bit on the Gleason scoring system, how it works?
Yes, the Gleason score is a pathologist's review of the actual sample they take from the prostate, and it's to determine the differentiation of cells within the prostate. In other words, the most differentiated cells are the ones that he's looking for to determine a numeric scale of 2 to 10. Anything prior to up until 6 is not considered to be particularly aggressive. 7 to 10 is considered to be aggressive or on a graduating scale. And this is an opinion by a pathologist based on what he looks at through a microscope at the cells. And the most differentiated cells are the ones that give him the clue as to how aggressive the prostate might be or the cancer might be.
Okay, so where did this take you next then?
Well, the next thing was sheer panic, because the way that I was told that I had cancer was over the telephone in literally an 8-second conversation where he simply said, "Yep, you got cancer. I want you to read this book by Patrick Walsh and come in and see me." And he hung up on me.
Right.
Well, as you can imagine,
supported.
All I heard was the word. Oh, yeah. All I heard was the word cancer.
Yeah.
I didn't hear anything else. And my upbringing, which was very much working class English from Coventry, all that, when I hear cancer, and my father had had prostate cancer and died of the treatment, which we'll talk about in a moment, not of the disease. All I heard was cancer, and I took that as being I'm going to die. And because of what I understood about cancer at that time, I was going to die soon. So I totally freaked out, and it took me about 4 days, to be quite honest, to sort of come around to the idea that I could deal with this. And it was only after that freak-out period that I just came to the conclusion that I can deal with this. And that was the start of my journey. And I did go back to that doctor. I tried to find that particular book he told me about, which I didn't read at the time, but I read later. And at that time, I had no health insurance. Now, this is something that English people perhaps don't understand, but in America, we have an insurance system that you can either have insurance or not have insurance. And I had none at that time, simply because of a situation with the Screen Actors Guild and the transition between the Screen Actors Guild and what we call Medicare. And so at that very moment, I had no insurance. So I went to the doctor on a car. He, in a very offhanded manner, said, "Go talk to the nurse. She deals with that." And I went to talk to the nurse, and she looked it up, and it was like $43,000. And I said, "Well, that ain't going to happen, because I don't have that kind of money." And I said, "Look, if my insurance company was this," which I'd had up until about a month prior to this examination, "if they'd come in and with the same thing, how much would they pay for the same surgery?" And they looked it up, and it was about $23,000. I said, "Okay, I'll go for that." And they said, "Oh, we can't do that." And I said, "Why not?" I said, "Because that's a fee they've negotiated. That's a discount they've negotiated through insurance." And I said, "Well, I'm negotiating with you now. I'll offer you the same money the insurance company will pay you." And they wouldn't do it. And I literally turned right around. Yeah, well, you know, I mean, this is a land of the free and the brave, et cetera.
Yeah, yeah.
And when I understood that, I just turned around and I walked out, and I've never been back. And I've never gone back to that doctor or any other doctor. And now we're 13 years later, and I'm far better educated, not only in the ways of the medical system, but in the ways of natural medicine and the control that we actually have over our own bodies if we only take the time to understand it and move in that direction.
Hmm. So maybe you'd like to tell us exactly what you did about your situation and how long it took before you felt that you were actually well again.
Well, I read a book by Larry Clapp called Prostate Health in 90 Days, and that was the first thing I read that led me to believe that what my urologist was telling me wasn't the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, you know? Mm-hmm. And it was a book about how your body can respond to certain natural treatments and how cancer can be reversed. And I also read about 12 other books in the same period of time, including the book by Patrick Walsh, which was merely a book that stated that surgery was the golden standard and that's the way you better deal with it. And it wasn't until afterwards that I read about a lot of the failures that Patrick Walsh had with cutting out prostates and how some pretty famous people had almost died on his table. And I'm glad I didn't choose to go in that direction. Mm. But I read all of these books and I decided that the most logical for me was to pursue natural health. And that's when I started studying by talking to doctors, because once you read the books, you get some knowledge, but you don't really get a clear view, in my opinion, of how that affects you individually. Right. And so I went to some doctors and I got some background on my own health. We did a functional blood analysis, for instance, to find out what my body is deficient in or was deficient in. We did urine and fecal analysis to find out what my body was toxic with. And then we did both blood and saliva panels to find out what was going on with all my various hormones. And that gave me the first picture as to really what my health was. And at no other time in my entire life had I understood what my body was doing. And all of a sudden I looked at this and I'm going, boy, this is really enlightening. Mm. And I found by changing certain things and taking certain supplements and leveling out my hormones and looking at the amino acids and balancing the amino acids and stuff like this, I found my entire health was improving. I lost 30 pounds. With moderate exercise, not massive exercise, but moderate exercise, I found my breathing was better, my attitude was better, my optimism was far better than it ever was in probably the preceding 10 years, and I found my health had improved considerably. And then within a period of time, because the PSA test in itself was never a function for me, because even when I was diagnosed, it was only 1.2. As you know, when you get to like age 61, which I was at the time I was diagnosed, the PSA, anything under 4, nobody bothers about. But what I found out later was 30% of all men with prostate cancer have low PSAs.
30%? I didn't realize it was that high.
The numbers that I'm going to give you are numbers I've learned about the USA. I understand that most of them you can translate into UK statistics, but I wouldn't guarantee that. I'll only tell you what I know about here. But that's the number that I've been told here, that 30% of all the men that are diagnosed with prostate cancer, their PSA is under 4. Hmm. And normally that wouldn't be an issue, and 1.2 certainly wouldn't have been an issue.
Yeah, everybody does say the PSA is pretty useless, and you're just confirming it.
Yeah. Yeah, but I didn't know that at the time. I learned this as we went through this, and what I did in my documentary is pretty much show that that the PSA was it's a marker of inflammation. That's all. And inflammation sometimes is caused by cancer. Often it's caused by many other things. And the other thing, which is kind of interesting, and this is something I got from a European study, is that the PSA, which stands for prostate-specific antigen, which is a protein that's produced when the prostate is inflamed, actually men produce that in their breast. In other words, if I was to thump a man in his breast, the PSA would spike. Right. And also now they're finding that the PSA can be measured in women.
Oh.
And that women actually have a PSA level, which is kind of interesting. And so what they're finding through continuous research, of course, is that this prostate-specific antigen is certainly not prostate-specific anymore.
Right.
And in fact, Richard Abelin, who was the man, the scientist that discovered this particular protein, said in the very beginning when he discovered it that this is not an indicator of cancer. But the entire medical profession ignored him and plowed ahead anyway, and as a result of which, many, many men have undergone considerable conventional treatment when it was unnecessary. Mm. And that's been a real issue with what I found out over the last 10 or 12 years. You know?
Right. Okay, so anyway, you did a lot of things to take your own sort of personal well-being in tow. You did your research, you changed your diet, your exercise regime, you took supplements, all these kind of things. Anything else on top of that? Anything?
Yes, and it took a long time to learn this because, like a lot of people, and I say this about men particularly, I was not very much in touch with my emotional state. And probably never had been. And what I found out, primarily by studying German New Medicine and through the tuition of a doctor called Gilbert Renaud, who's a French-Canadian, I learned about recall healing, and I learned about how a man's emotional state can affect the chance that he will recover from cancer or not. And one of the things that we teach here now with men that come to us that have had their prostate removed and the cancers come back, is almost the first thing we take a look at is what emotional traumas are they still carrying around with them all of these years that's preventing them from recovering. And what we're finding is it's tremendous. The Center for Disease Control over here, which is a government organization, came out with a paper that said 85% of all chronic diseases have an emotional component. And of course, prostate cancer being a chronic disease. Stanford University did a similar study and came up with a number that was closer to 95%. And I have doctors that will swear that it's 100%. And so when I found this out, I had to set about looking at my own life and figuring out what it was in my life that was affecting or not allowing my cancer to disappear totally. Yeah. And I find that there's items in my life that I'd never really gotten over. These were emotional traumas I'd never addressed, never recovered from, and was carrying around on a cellular level. The minute I addressed these things, all of a sudden, the cancer went away. And I believe it's a combination of things, not just emotional, although some doctors will say you can't recover without it. But I think the entire program of looking at the health of my body, looking at what toxins I had in my body, typically for prostate cancer, we find mercury, nickel, cadmium, and lead. Once you get rid of those, which includes getting rid of the amalgams and fillings in your mouth, and looking at the hormonal situation, men with prostate cancer generally have elevated estrogens, E2 particularly, estradiol, and depleted testosterones, particularly what we call free testosterone. Once you look at all of that and you go, God, it's no wonder I'm sick. Mm. And I'm 75 this year. It's been now 13 years since I was diagnosed.
Right.
And in so many respects, I'm healthier now than I was in my 50s.
Mm. So you've made efforts to clean up your system of heavy metals then? Have you done specific things about that?
Yes, and DMPS is one of the things we used. And we've done some chelation therapy. I do all of this, of course, under the supervision of a doctor. I have a couple of doctors I work with. And I've never taken on any of these things without the supervision of a qualified doctor. And I use the word qualified very specifically because just because someone is an MD does not mean to say he's qualified to treat you for prostate cancer or to treat you for chelation or any of the things that I found necessary in terms of dealing with this particular cancer. So it's important to find a doctor that not only understands that, but is sympathetic to the way you want to treat the disease rather than a conventional surgery, radiation, or Lupron, Casodex, Flutamide, or any of those drugs, you know.
Mm-hmm. I just want to pick up on one thing you said. You said, you used the phrase, we teach here now. So who is we and where are you teaching?
Well, the we is sometimes the royal we.
Okay.
But I get to talk in front of, I've never forgotten that part, actually, the royal we. But I speak frequently in front of layman's groups that are put together. I have a lifelong relationship with motorcycling, and I was an employee
that, yeah,
of Triumph back in the early 60s. And so I get to speak at motorcycle groups at dealerships that they put together, sometimes in anywhere from 80 to 120 people that I would talk to. And I do that regularly. I also speak in front of doctors' groups, because most doctors are not educated in this kind of treatment. And I speak in front of naturopathic and MDs. Certain groups like the Labrix group, which is a laboratory in Portland, invite me to speak because I have some very specific knowledge that I've learned over the years that they want me to share with the doctors that go to their seminars. And I just spoke recently at a place called Best Answer for Cancer. And I speak at the Cancer Control Society, which is a naturopathic group, every year. And so that's the people I address. The treatment side is I work with a couple of doctors, and that's the we, where I actually talk to the patient first and work with them to find out what their general attitudes are. Then when it comes to doing specific tests, I then bring in the MDs that I work with, and they actually perform the doctoral duties, if you like. Mm-hmm. And so it becomes like a team process. I talk to them about my experiences. And then when it comes time to drawing blood and doing the blood test or sending off the fecal urine analysis to the lab, that kind of thing, that's where the doctor comes in, and the doctor takes over for that part of the treatment.
Mm. Well, look, this is very canny. Your activism, if you like, has sort of strayed into other areas of your life. You've obviously had a lifelong love affair with motorcycling, and you've managed to use that to good effect to get yourself a captive audience of men, which is very clever. And your previous life in filmmaking has played into your current role in promoting being an activist about prostate cancer. So would you like to fill us in a little bit on the lead up, you know, why you got this thing about motorcycling and what you've done, and also in filmmaking, how you got to where you are now?
Well, the motorcycling was actually pretty interesting. I went to school in Coventry, and the art master at my school, I was one of the first intakes into a comprehensive school in 1954, a school called Callerton Castle. And in the last year there, in the fifth form, as we took the O-levels in those days, my art teacher would come to work on with a motorcycle and sidecar. And on the sidecar, it was a platform, was this racing motorcycle. And he would come in on a Friday afternoon and then go off racing for the weekend. And that, just watching that, right, inspired me all about motorcycling. And so when the opportunity came for me to go work for Triumph, I just jumped at it and worked for Triumph for 4 years and had 4 years of racing in Europe, all over Europe, actually, in the last year that I was there, 64. And I came to America initially to race at Daytona. Mm. And that particular thing didn't work out, but it allowed me to get a green card into America at the time. And when I was at Daytona, I met a disc jockey from a local radio station who thought it was amazing to have an Englishman there with a thick Midlands accent, which I've since pretty much gotten rid of.
But yeah, but, not much
sign now. No. And he put me on the radio and interviewed me about the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and what have you. And I was young. I was like 22 years old then. And I was full of vim and vigor. And to me, it was a huge joke. I was having a great time. But what I found out very quickly was I could make a lot more money being on the radio than I could racing motorcycles. So anyway, they offered me a job. I took it and I stayed here. And I was on the radio for 6 years. And as a rock and roll disc jockey, and that later led into record production. You might remember an English band called the Spencer Davis Group.
Certainly do.
I brought them to America and produced the first American album, and that led into actually meeting up with some motorcycle people in 1973, and that's how I got involved in documentary filmmaking in 73 by making a film called The Bad Rock about an international 6 days trial, and was sponsored by a motorcycle company, and that led into basically 20 years of making films about motorcycling and motorcycle racing. And then that led into the building of some very special motorcycles for the movie industry, and to 9 years of being a stunt guy in movies like Batman and Robin and Apollo 13 and films of that like, and hundreds of commercials. And that went on until 1999, when I had one huge accident, and that put me out of action for 9 months, and I never went back into that business. And then 3 years later, I got diagnosed with prostate cancer. And that changed my life entirely and brought me right through to where I am today. You know? So I still ride motorcycles a lot. Right. In fact, I have a new book coming out in September called Motorcycle Traveler about the 10 countries that I've ridden motorcycles in the last 5 years.
Anyway, it's armed you in an unexpected way for being an activist. So to do with cancer, at what point do you think you changed from being a cancer patient to a cancer activist, and why?
That's an interesting question. I think it happened when Larry Clapp, who was the guy whose book that I had read, he and I met and became friends. And he looked at my experience as a documentary filmmaker for 20 some odd years. And he said, you need to make a documentary about this. And I didn't take him up on it initially because I'd sort of finished with that part of my life, so I thought. And never did. I just continued with my studying and related to it only in as much as it affected my recovery and getting into better health. And but he kept at it. And finally, I said, okay, I'll go interview some doctors and that I've met, and we'll start putting a program together. And I did. And it took me about 3 years to travel to the different countries and visit the doctors that I visited, like Thomas Rau in Listmuller in Switzerland, and Dowers in Bad Aibling in Germany, and Kessler in Northern Germany, and a couple of doctors in England, Chris Astle-Smith and Julian Kenyon in England. And then I went to Australia to look at some treatment there they had called photodynamic therapy that was being somewhat successful there. And eventually, over a 3.5 year period, put it together into the state that it is today. And it's a 3 DVD disc set. One disc, which is an hour and 45 minutes long, is basically the documentary. The other two discs contain information that go beyond the documentary, where, as an example, if you like what Dr. Cannell has to say about vitamin D and you want to know more of what Dr. Cannell thinks, then you can go to the other discs and look him up alphabetically and listen to watch what he has to say and listen to what he has to say over and above what he states in the documentary. And it's taken over my life in so many ways. And the more I seem to help introducing people, the more I want to do it.
Yep.
It's the internal rewards are quite amazing when people call you up and say, thank God I saw your documentary when it was on television. I met this doctor and they tell me their story. And I'm going, it's in terms of being grateful for it, I'm glad I've had this opportunity. Because it's put a part of my life alive that I'd never experienced in all of the filmmaking I've done, all of the stuff I've done on radio. It doesn't make me as satisfied as it does when I get a phone call from somebody saying, thank you. It's still amazing.
Great.
It's amazing.
Great. So in making this film, what do you think were your aims? What are you trying to achieve directly?
Mainly to convince people that there is another way. In fact, my phrase I like to use is when I left the doctor's office after they told me they wanted $43,000 to remove the prostate, I walked away saying, there's got to be a better way. And that's what started the research. And I found out, yes, there is a better way, a much better way. And that what you learn is that I'm not saying people shouldn't have their prostate removed. That's a very personal decision, you know. And to be quite honest, a lot of wives will say to the husband, do what the doctor tells you. If the doctor says take it out, take it out. And a lot of men, unfortunately, don't question the doctor. And they say, the doctor says, you've got to take that out. And a man will say, it's Tuesday soon enough. Can we do it on, you know, like, can we get it over with? Can I get And that's a very, very unusual thing for men to say, because after surgery, the things that most men suffer with, impotence, incontinence, their wives don't understand that when they tell them to take it out. It's only when afterwards that they're having to deal with a lack of libido, lack of interest in sex, a lack of interest in their marriage a lot of times. They don't understand that's going to be part of what they're going to have to deal with. And then when the cancer comes back, which it inevitably does, and the statistics for that are kind of shocking, but nobody talks about it. Then they say, oh boy. And I work a lot with men where the cancer has come back and they're totally freaked out, and we start from scratch in trying to get them to understand what they have to do to resolve those issues. And part of it is the support of their wife, the support of the woman in their lives. And it would be much better if in the very beginning they would question what the doctor says, start doing some research, and have their wife involved in the beginning, and having the wife understand that if they do this, there is a consequence to that. Mm. And there's no guarantee the cancer is going to go away for anything, whether you remove the prostate, radiate it, or have Lupron or Casodex or Flutamide, any of those drugs, there is no guarantee the cancer will go away. And there is no guarantee it'll go away if you do it naturally either. The difference is you stand a much better chance if you clean up your life and understand that the reason you have cancer is based on your life that you've led up to that point, and you better start thinking about some changes. Hmm. That's what we try to teach.
Okay, makes sense to me. All right, so you've already said you traveled to a lot of places. How many countries did you say you went to? 8 countries, was it?
I went to 8 countries on 3 continents in putting the documentary together. What I will say is I'm coming to the UK in July.
All right.
And I'm giving 8 talks, and I'm showing my movie Take It to the Limit at 8 motorcycle dealerships. And this is like a test market to see whether the British people will respond the same way that Americans respond. And what it'll mean is I will give a talk for about 20 to 30 minutes before showing the movie Take It to the Limit, which is a motorcycle movie. And then afterwards, I stay behind and do a Q&A for people that want more detailed information about the prostate experience. And we're going to give it a shot and see how the public responds. And if they respond well, hopefully we can come back and do more. But I'm looking at doing either 6 or 8 in July. We haven't got it nailed down yet. We've got 3 committed. We've got 5 currently looking at it in a serious manner. And I hope by the end of another week, I'll have either 6 or 8 nailed down, and I'll be able to give you the dates in July when I'll be there.
Fantastic. Well, look, if we can get a link to the right place for your program, I'll make sure that goes out associated to the show. Apart from the alternatives to conventional treatment, which are obviously appear in your film, you obviously talk about those. What other aspects of prostate cancer and prostate cancer treatment does it cover? Does it go into all these things like the testing and the scans and the biopsy and the side effects? Are they all looked at in the film?
Yes, it's all addressed in the documentary. The main thing is all of that is talked about, but the main thing I want to put across is if you think you have prostate cancer or if you have been diagnosed with it, it behooves you to get the best education you can very quickly before you make decisions. Because I don't know about the UK, because I'm not sure how doctors get paid there by the way they give treatments. But over here, a urologist only gets paid when he treats you. So it's in the urologist's best interest for him to convince you to have surgery, because he's a surgeon. And if you don't, he doesn't make any money off you. Hmm. The radiologist makes the money. Hmm. And yeah. Well, what I'm trying to say is that without actually saying which treatment you should do, you need to have the best education quickly. And I think with the documentary, most men prefer to look at something rather than read. So if they watch this documentary, they'll get a very quick education about what it's, you know, what they're dealing with. And then you can only make a better decision if you're better educated.
Well, you're right. You described yourself how you went in there and you didn't even know what the word biopsy meant, and you said yes anyway. And I think most people are in that situation with regards to cancer, because nobody basically wants to know about cancer, do they? They just want to hope that it's not going to get them. And they don't know what chemotherapy means or anything. They just know it's all bad. So you're saying that your documentary is basically going to help men with answering the kind of, well, first knowing what questions they should have and then how to go about answering them as quickly as possible.
Well, the way that I try to get people to look at it here is look at the documentary and then write down the questions that you have. And then if your doctor doesn't want to answer them to your satisfaction, call us. We'll talk to you on the telephone and we'll give you our opinion of it. I much prefer that people find a local physician to work with, because I think that's important. And it's important to have a good relationship with, and I don't care if they're a naturopathic doctor or a doctor of osteopathy or an MD, as long as they understand that surgery and radiation are not necessarily the answers for prostate cancer. Yes, they work some of the time, there's no doubt about it, otherwise they would have been banned a long time ago. But the fact that they don't work so much of the time, and the after effects, the side effects, or as I like to call them, the direct effects of that treatment, can be devastating to marriages and to people, and to the fact that they do not control the fact that the cancer will come back. And those are things to understand before you choose a treatment, and we try to get that across, you know.
Okay. And do you think you feel that the conventional techniques have got no place at all in treating prostate cancer? Or would you say that if someone is asking the kind of questions you're asking about why they got cancer, that they could still play a part?
Well, I think, as I said, I don't think conventional medicine is bad for everybody. I don't. But I don't think you should take on conventional treatment lightly, thinking that it's going to resolve all of the issues. That's the thing that I want to say, is that because I see so many men where they've had conventional treatment that hasn't worked, and they don't know what to do or where to go from there. But I do acknowledge the fact that for a lot of people it has worked, and it's worked well enough so they can get on with their life, and their life is good enough. But there are treatments now on the horizon that actually, and the UK leads the way in a couple of these things that I think are really interesting. There's a new twist on the treatment called photodynamic therapy.
Yes.
I've watched that over the last 10 years. And in fact, I went to Australia 10 years ago to film it and to learn about it. And then I also went to some other places to watch it. And photodynamic therapy in this country has been legal for skin cancer for a long time, but it's never been legal for prostate cancer, and still isn't, by the way. It's they use it in Mexico and some other countries, but I never saw it work to my satisfaction, because they couldn't get the light into the prostate in such a way that it would activate the sensitizer to kill the cancer. Right. Now, however, through the Weizmann Institute and Steber Biotech, they've got this 2CAD soluble, which there's been a clinical trial in the UK, which is very, very promising. They did a clinical trial in Germany, and they're about to do some second clinical trials here in America on it. And if it shows the same promise here as it's done in Europe, I actually think in terms of conventional treatment, it may well be the answer. Hmm. It still doesn't stop the cancer coming back, and it still doesn't resolve the issues that are in the body to start with. But I think it'll become the best of the conventional treatments, and certainly would be something that I would recommend people take a serious look at.
Hmm. Yeah, well, I would agree with that. Do you want to give a bit of an explanation for our listeners about what PDT is?
Yeah, absolutely. Originally, photodynamic therapy was invented at Harvard University, and it consists of a liquid they call a sensitizer, which was based on a chlorophyll plant base, and they would give you that orally in the very beginning, and they would give you time for that to get to the cancer cells. And what it does, it is attracted to cancer-only cells, and then what they do is they give you this frequency of light, which literally allows the sensitizer to create oxygen, and the oxygen killed the cancer cells. And that was approved for skin cancer and cancers that were less than 1 centimeter under the skin, and still is approved for that in America today. Somebody suggested that could be done for prostate, and there was a lot of tests done, but there was never anything that really worked, because they could never get the light into the prostate. What they do now is they've taken a page out of the brachytherapy book, and they go in with some tubes through the perineum directly into the prostate, just like you were putting in radioactive seeds. But this time they put in this new 2CAD soluble liquid, which also is a bacteria-based ocean bacteria that they put in there, that has the same effect on cancer cells. But the light source this time is put in through the very same tubes that they introduced the liquid into it, and which are photo-optic tubes. and they introduced the light directly into the prostate, not having to go through any other tissue whatsoever. And that seems to have a great effect on killing the cancer. And as I said, the two clinical trials that I've seen results of have been incredibly promising. I'm just hopeful that we'll have the same results in America, and this may, in the next 2 or 3 years, see a really good option to surgery and radiation that will be available to men that are diagnosed.
So this has the quality that it only targets cancer cells, and it's essentially non-toxic. It doesn't do any harm. So even if you have, it doesn't quite do the job, you could go back and have it done again. Yeah, that's
also correct.
Yeah, it's a huge plus, really. So, yeah, I think I agree with you that it would be a massive step for conventional treatment if they actually adopted this. I mean, to me, PDT is one of the greatest sort of disgraces of orthodox medicine, because it's been around for a long time, and it's been shown to work with solid tumours, as you say, provided you can get the light source there, it works. And it has those advantages we just discussed there. But we got to the stage where Britain has pioneered an awful lot of the science here in PDT. And I talked to one of the leading people involved, and he was saying how they can now make the complete kit for PDT and sell it for about £8,000 and treat people for about £200 a pop. So where are they getting this? Third world countries. They're actually better off because they haven't got much money. They get these really rather good treatments that would never be considered in this country. You know, we don't do anything that costs £200 here, you know, because, of course, they don't make enough money. It's shocking, really. But
well, money is the big thing. There's and England was one of the forerunners in a process, in a treatment called HIFU.
Yes.
High intensity focused ultrasound. I see now where the urologists that are doing the research in the UK have pretty much dropped HIFU in favor of this new version of photodynamic therapy. And I have some patients here that have come to me that have had HIFU in America, and they're not happy with it. In fact, it was only been made legal in America as of about last September. And if you wanted to get HIFU here for cash, you would go to Canada or the Bahamas to get it done. And I've seen a large number of patients that have come to us where it's not worked, and they've paid out $25,000 or in some cases $50,000. They've had to have it done twice, and it just hasn't worked. And it's still not approved for insurance payments over here. So if you want to do HIFU, it's still $25,000 a treatment, or in some places, $40,000 a treatment. And people think they can go do that. It's going to cure the cancer. What I try to tell them is the reason you got the cancer is still inside your body. It's still systemic. You've got to change what you do, the way you think, the way you eat, and so on, because that's what's brought you to this moment in time where the cancer took hold in the first place. And if you just think you're going to locally deal with it through HIFU or anything else, the cancer will come back somewhere else. It inevitably does. And we try to educate people to that point and get them to change their lives. Right. Sometimes we're successful, sometimes we're not, you know.
Right. Anyway, there's a lot of hope in some of these much less toxic conventional therapies, though, that they do have a real place, of course. If you can treat the cancer and change your lifestyle, you're in a pretty good position then, aren't you?
I think so. And it's why when people say, well, I've decided to have surgery, I say, fine, because that's your decision. It's your life. But I said, please consider all these other things, because what you need to do if you have surgery and you're happy with that is understand that you can still change your diet and lifestyle and the way you think and your hormones that will give you a better chance of the cancer not coming back.
Okay. I wanted to ask how sort of US-centric the film is. I mean, is it likely to be as much help to somebody here in the UK as it is for an American?
I don't think it's US-centric at all, actually, because many of the doctors are from other countries, Canada and Switzerland and Germany and England, and by Canada, French side of Canada, as well as the English-speaking side of Canada, Australia. So I don't think it's particularly US-centric at all. It's quite universal. And of course, I mean, the disease, to be quite honest, is very universal. I mean, the prostate cancer you get in the UK is exactly the same problem we have here. There's no difference. You know?
And do you have any ideas how many people have seen your film so far?
Well, it was on American television last year, a version of it. We have a very strange television system here, and we had to cut it down to 60 minutes to get it on television. So the people that watched it did not get the entire documentary at all. But it was very successful in getting people to think about what prostate cancer was about. And we had a lot of feedback, telephone feedback from people that saw it. I would estimate that it's probably been seen by 700,000 or 800,000 people on television. Mm-hmm. And we've probably sold of the three, that's of the 60 minute version. And of the three DVD sets, we've probably sold 4,000, maybe 3,500, maybe. Mm. We actually sell to the UK. Unfortunately, it's a little expensive to ship it to the UK. But and we've tried to get UK distribution for it, but nobody's shown much interest. What we're working on now is a way to have it as a download,
right,
rather than a DVD disc. And I don't know exactly when that'll be available as a download. We're reworking our website at the moment, so it will accommodate a download. It's something we're currently doing. I just don't know exactly when it'll be done. I'm not terribly technical when it comes to the internet and designing these things, but we're working on it, you know.
Well, that would be a great thing. I mean, you know, obviously the reason people would want to buy the DVDs is because it sounds like there's a fantastic amount of information in there, and they'll want to revisit it regularly and go into more depth in particular bits. So a download situation where you can actually, again, gain permanent access to the material will be great, just as good.
Yeah, exactly. And I just don't know when it's going to be available. The guy that's actually redesigning the website thinks it'll be another 3 months before we actually get it ready and get it up online. But so for the next 3 months at least, it'll have to be a DVD that that people buy. But also, as you say, you've got the DVD in your hand, you can watch it anytime you want and continue to watch it. You bought it, it's yours, you know. Mm-hmm. There's a booklet inside the kit. It's a resource guide, and it's the contact information for every one of the doctors that we interview. Mm. And the reason I did this was because one of the criticisms that naturopaths and people like me get all the time from conventional medicine is that we're a bunch of quacks. Mm-hmm. And people say, oh, you're not a doctor, what do you know? You know, well, the honest answer is a lot of the times we know more than a lot of doctors because they just don't study these things. And to make sure that people understand that we've got credentialed people of high quality, every doctor in this documentary, we've put in this resource guide that name, address, phone number, credentials, a description about who they are and what their specialty is, so that people can say, oh, that's what Dr. Cannell is. That's what he's about. Or this is what Dr. Rao is about, and he's in Switzerland, or Dr. Kenyon in the UK. And they can see that. And if they want to pick up the phone and call them, they can.
Well, that's great. Okay, well, I think we're going to have to wrap it up there. Thanks an awful lot for telling us about your film and all your work. Really interesting, Peter, and I really look forward to meeting you in person when you come over.
Likewise, Robin, absolutely. If I may just give a plug to our website, it's called survivingprostatecancer.org. We are a charity. We're a 501c3 in America, as we call a registered charity over here, which means that everything, people donate money. We do not charge for consultations at this point. We try to do it as best as we can for free. And that may have to change in the future because we're actually growing at a rate that I'm going to have to pay people to come work for us. Mm-hmm. And that's going to change the financial side of things. But right at the moment, you know, that's the way we're working. So if they go to the website, and we'll have a new website under the same name, hopefully within the next 3 months, and we'll be much more digital oriented than we are at present time.
Well, I'm glad to hear you're having such success.
Wonderful. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye. Bye.
See you, Robin. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
If you'd like a copy of Peter's film, you can find full details on the Yes to Life website. Just go to yestolife.org.uk, click Media Centre in the left-hand sidebar, and then choose UK Health Radio. You'll also find other links to resources mentioned in the show. And a quick reminder of a couple of things. Our book, The Cancer Revolution by Patricia Pete of Cancer Options, is available at thecancerrevolution.co.uk. It brings together 38 international experts, many of whom have been my guests on this show, to provide a thorough introduction to all aspects of integrative medicine for cancer. Do visit the website and take a look. And finally, details of a couple of events coming up in the Yes to Life calendar. On the 10th of June, there's a visit to the linseed farm near Horsham, which will include information on the many health benefits of linseed from the proprietor and linseed expert Derwin Banks, along with a delicious organic lunch. And on the 22nd of June, there's an evening talk entitled Uncovering a New Perspective in Integrative Oncology, Medicinal Mushrooms. This will be in Camden, London. Hope you enjoyed the show and will want to join me again next week. Goodbye.